Hi, it's Tracy. Before we start, I have a request. Okay, it's a little weird, maybe even a lot weird, but hello, 6.5 million downloads on my podcast, and still we haven't chosen a sponsor, right? Yeah, they just haven't been good enough for us, and that's a little weird too. So I decided I'm going to treat this like a sponsorship spot. Many of you know Marcus, my son, who's been the inspiration behind this podcast, the book, my programs, anything at all to do with ADHD. Well, he is graduating from NYU this May, and boy, are we happy that he did it in 4 years. So anyway, Marcus loves to travel, and so he's spending 6 weeks by himself traveling to 5 countries in South America. I don't know about you, but there's no way in hell that I would go to even one country alone. And so we gave Marcus a very low budget. This trip is a combination of his birthday and graduation gift, and he figured it all out himself. He speaks some Spanish, but he hired a Spanish tutor from Ecuador a couple weeks ago, months maybe, who's a professor at a university there, and this professor is helping him with his conversational Spanish. Marcus also changed his phone to Spanish only and all of his apps, and he only watches Spanish TV in preparation for this trip. So that gives you a little bit of an idea of what Marcus is like. Now, Marcus would ultimately like to earn a PhD in psychology. He's fascinated by the brain, learning differences, and particularly how dyslexia impacts math. For the near future, though, he wants to work for a couple of years in New York City. I never thought he'd say that. He was always looking for more nature. So anyway, he's going on this trip, and what he's trying to do is find a job that he can come back to. He's come very close, but still no cigar. So yes, I am hawking my son's skills on these airwaves. He thinks I'm insane. But I'm like, who knows what interesting people are out there? I mean, I found my husband in a personal ad when no one was doing that. So why not find a job using my podcast? I mean, ultimately, finding a partner or finding a job, it's all the same thing, right? It's marketing, just getting the word out. Right job, right person. So that's my weird request. If you have any leads in New York City, Marcus would love to work in advertising or marketing sales. He's a phenomenal researcher. I promise you, he can find anything. He's very skilled in Excel and financial modeling. He'd be amazing in digital advertising or tech marketing. And beyond his hard skills, he's resilient. He's so smart. And he has an exceptional work ethic. And that's not just his mother talking. He's not like me. He prefers not to challenge the status quo all the time. He actually likes structure and systems. And he has so many ideas about how to make things better, faster, more efficient, simpler. So I'm putting this out there to our incredible community. If you know of any opportunities in digital advertising, tech marketing, or sales that are in New York City and could benefit from a bright, hardworking, and respectful young professional like my son Marcus, send me an email at support@tracyoutsuka.com and I will connect the two of you. Look, Marcus represents the very essence of what we talk about here every week, right? The brilliance of thinking differently. And so does his mother. So thank you for letting me be weird. And now let's get on with the show.
You're better off making a decision and making your decision the right one. And you have no way of knowing how that other thing would have turned out. There's no sense in saying, oh, I should have done this. No, you shouldn't have, because you don't know how that would have turned out. You really don't, because you didn't do it. Now, they have seen that Jeopardy players who have quick buzzer skills, they actually practice hitting the buzzer faster, they are more likely to win. Now, why is that? Because they're hitting the buzzer before they know the correct answer. So that's what you need to do in life, is you have to make that decision before you're even 100% sure that something is the right thing to do. Because you will win in life when you're making quicker decisions.
Ah, so you're in action instead of in your head.
Yes, like you say.
Thomas Edison, Richard Branson, John F. Kennedy,
Mozart, Michael Jordan, Will Smith. That sounds like a list of highly successful titans in a variety of vocations. Why is it that we rarely hear that they have or had ADHD? And you know what we hear even less about? Serena Williams, Emma Watson, Mel Robbins, Whoopi Goldberg, Agatha Christie, Erin Brockovich, Cher. Yeah, the successful women navigating ADHD. And that's exactly why I started this podcast, ADHD for Smartass Women. I'm your host, Tracy Otsuka. I'm a lawyer, not a doctor, a lifelong student, now a coach. I'm also the creator of Your ADHD Brain is A-OK, a system that helps people like you figure out what they should do with their life. And we're here today to talk ADHD, your strengths, your symptoms, your workarounds, and how you proudly stand out instead of trying to fit in. I credit my ADHD for some of my greatest gifts. And you know what? I spy a happier life for you, too. So without further ado, a shiny new episode is starting now. Hello, I am your host, Tracy Otsuka. Thank you so much for joining me here for episode number 212 of ADHD for Smartass Women. I hope you'll subscribe to this podcast and our newsletter over at tracyotsuka.com. My purpose is always to show you who you are and then inspire you to be it. And today's guest, Miriam Shulman, is an artist, author, and host of the Inspiration Place podcast. She's helped thousands of creatives around the world develop their skill sets and create more time and freedom to do what they love. Her signature coaching program, the Artist Incubator, teaches artists to go from so-so sales to sold-out collections. After witnessing 9/11, Miriam abandoned a lucrative hedge fund to become a full-time, thriving, working artist. Featured in major publications including Forbes, Entrepreneur, The New York Times, Where Women Create, Art of Man, and Art Journaling Magazine. Her artwork has also been featured on NBC's Parenthood and the Amazon series Hunters with Al Pacino. When I decided that I wanted to write a book, I knew that I needed someone to help me with the book proposal, which is the first step you take to find a literary agent. I didn't know Miriam, but a friend alerted me to an Instagram post where she announced her book deal with HarperCollins. So I contacted Miriam asking about book proposal coaches, and she was so generous with her recommendations. And as luck would have it, we now have the same publisher, just a different imprint. But because Miriam is a year ahead of me, she's been such an amazing resource. Now, her book, with HarperCollins leadership, Artpreneur, is officially out. Artpreneur provides the actionable steps to turn your creative ideas into a thriving business. Please welcome to the podcast, Miriam Shulman. Miriam, I feel like we need like one of those cheering sections.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did I get all of that right? Oh my God.
You did. You were a rock star. So do you mind if I tell your listeners about stumbling over words? Because they should know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So like Artpreneur got stuck in Tracy's throat. And I said, just wait until you record the audiobook. And like some sentences we had to record like several times. So I just recorded my audiobook. And it's no joke. Like these words, and I constantly had to have the audio engineer, could you look up how this is pronounced?
Yeah. And it's, I mean, does that ever happen to you where it's simple words, you don't know how to pronounce them or you don't know how to spell them, and you've done it all your life, and all of a sudden there's just a glitch?
Well, part of my audiological processing is that I do sometimes have trouble pronouncing simple words. So that is part of it. But during the 2 days that I was recording, I was sharing that with one of the voice actors who was there to record something else. And he said, oh, no, that's not because, like, you always think it's because of your learning difference, your neurodiversity. He says, oh, no, we all have to do that. It's like, oh, okay.
But I
do stumble. Like my podcast editor sometimes have to say to me, what did you mean here?
Well, and I don't even notice. I'll have people send me messages after listening to the podcast, and they'll, you know, say something super nice. And then they will make a comment about, oh, and just so you know, you mispronounced blah, blah, blah. And I didn't even realize I mean, I know how to say it, but I didn't realize I mispronounced it on the podcast. So Anyway, our normal protocol is to start with our guest's ADHD story, but some of you may remember that Miriam came to talk to us about ADHD and creativity about, I don't know, 18, 19 months ago. So if you're interested in her ADHD story, you can go to episode number 136, and we'll link that in the show notes. But today I want to talk about your new book, which I believe will be so well received. And I think that's because, Miriam, you corral us in by making it clear that you're one of us, so there's no question that you share a nonlinear creative brain, but then you provide such simple, uncomplicated, straightforward advice for creative entrepreneurs. I just loved this book.
Oh, thanks. That means a lot to me coming from you, Tracy. I really appreciate it. You know, one thing that I think that people who are neurodiverse, our superpowers, is we do see the world differently. And sometimes that makes the world more difficult to navigate, but sometimes that's when we're able to see things others can't. That's why so many neurodiverse people make such wonderful artists and writers and creative, because we are looking at the world through a different lens. And I think that's what this book does, is I'm bringing to people, I'm connecting dots between things where you wouldn't normally make connections. And the other thing is, when I do talk about productivity, I'm really bringing in all the coping strategies that I learned over the years, because I have a neurodiverse brain, how I navigate that. So it definitely informed that section of the book.
So there's one thing that you said that I immediately identified with, certainly having an ADHD brain, and you just mentioned that to be an artist is actually to identify connections in the world, right? You help people see the world in a different way, but you also connected that to art, and you said that's exactly what art does.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I imagine there are artists who are not neurodiverse, but artists do help people see the world differently. That is our role. That's our role as artists, is to really help people see the world.
It's me again, Tracy. You know how people often assume that if you have ADHD, you're just lazy, unmotivated, and not living up to your full potential? Well, I'm here to tell you they've got it all wrong, except for the part about not reaching your full potential. But that's only because you haven't found the right strategies tailored for your unique ADHD brain. And that's exactly why I wrote ADHD for Smartass Women. This book, it's designed to help you understand the different approaches that work for your distinct brain, inspiring you to become the best version of yourself right now. You can grab a copy wherever books are sold. And if you've already read my book, please take a moment to leave a review on Amazon and Goodreads. Your feedback, it not only supports me and my publisher, but it also helps other smart-ass women and their kids, friends, and colleagues find the strategies they need to thrive. Every review makes a huge difference. So go write a review now, or buy the book now, before you forget. Okay, back to our usual programming.
So I'm curious, because you make it all seem so easy and clear and simple, do you think it's really not that hard to make a sustainable living using your creativity? And if yes, did you always feel that way? Or was it a problem for you initially?
Oh, no, I definitely did not always feel this way. And that's why I didn't go into art. That's why I went to Wall Street. You know, I was given the same Kool-Aid everybody else is. You can't make a living as an artist. You know, I came from a single parent household. My father had passed away when I was very young. I didn't have a trust fund or rich parents to fall back on. I had student loans. And when I was given the message, go make a lot of money, that's the point of working, I was like, fine, where do they make the most money? Wall Street. So that's why I went there. And
when I quit my job in right around 9/11, so I actually did quit the job. I like to tell the story that, and then 9/11 happened, and then I decided to be an artist. It's not exactly, that's the collapse narrative. So I quit my job, and 9/11 happened, and I decided, no way am I going back. I need to do something else. So I started off working at a gym where they were teaching us how to sell personal training packages. And when I understood, this is where the neurodiversity really helped. When I saw them teaching me how to sell training packages and all the techniques they were using, I saw that I could apply it to selling portraits. So I wasn't so literal to think this only works for what they wanted us to learn it for. And that's when I started selling my art. And because I understood that the whole way you succeed is by being a really good marketer, I learned as much as possible about marketing. And I still stand by that. A lot of trolls on the internet, Tracy, will say to me, what do you mean anyone can do this? What about talent? Or maybe people should just work on their art. And sadly, there are a lot of talented people who do not succeed in every industry.
Yes. Exactly.
Because they're not good marketers, and marketing and mindset, because you can't have good marketing unless you have a good mindset. Marketing and mindset will trump talent every time.
Well, and we know that to be true because we know so many people, right? Friends.
Yeah, we know so many people who are talented, who are floundering. And then you look at people who are succeeding. It's like, well, how did they get to the top?
Exactly. Okay, so let's back up a second and let's talk about what is art?
Okay, that's a great question. And a lot of people have been pushing me on that question. So when I first wanted to write this book, I wanted to write it for me. You know, just like for painters. And the publisher and my agent were like, well, you're not going to sell a lot of books that way. So you got to broaden the definition. So the art that in the book is, it's anything you create. So that could be pottery, that could be sculpture, that could be dance, that could be writing. But the truth is, Tracy, once you make the definition that broad, you really can stick anything in that. What is the art? Anything you create with your creative ideas. So if you are an ADHD coach, that is your art. If you're creating a podcast, that is your art. So it's all of those things.
Well, it's exactly bringing it back to what you said. It's being able to make those connections, right? And doing things in a different creative way. And I always hear, certainly, you know, my ADHD women or our ADHD women, they say, I'm not creative because they're thinking of creative in a visual arts or performing arts kind of way. Yet I remember in the process of you writing this book, you saying to me, my book is also my art.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it had to be. I mean, could you imagine? Like if I didn't put creativity into this? That would be the most boring book in the world.
So what did your writing process look like?
Oh, good Lord. So it changed throughout. I remember telling somebody was asking me that recently, and I said, yeah, well, for 2 weeks, I got up really early before, you know, I did the before breakfast thing, right? It lasted 2 weeks. I was so tired, and I was like, it doesn't matter what time of day you do it. I do believe, though, that we have our best energy, our best genius time early in the day, but that doesn't mean you have to get up at 6 or 7 in the morning, because and I'm sure you've talked about this too, Tracy, you get decision fatigue throughout the day, and so it makes harder to make decisions, especially creative decisions. So I did try to get my writing blocks in the morning, but when I wanted to, after exercise, like around 10 o'clock, I would have writing blocks of time. And I just would schedule it in my calendar. And what I said to myself was ass in the chair and ugly words, just get it done.
And so how long would you go for?
I don't think that I could go for more than 2 hours in a session. I mean, I can look back and tell you because I have like my written calendar right in front of me. But yeah, it's like it would have 4 hours of creativity in me. There's that myth that if only we had more hours in the day, we would get more done. And that's a lie because we just don't have more energy. You need a lot of energy to put out your best work. And I think most of us only have about 4 hours in us.
Yeah. You know, I am exactly the way you are on everything but writing. If I don't get it done in the morning, I mean, I just kind of drag it out, right? And it just takes longer and longer to get done. But there was something about writing. I could not, no matter how hard I tried, start before 2 or 3 o'clock. It just killed me.
Well, that's fine too. I mean, there's something about clearing the dust off your brain. Like if you can't sit down and write because you know you have all this admin stuff to do for your business, or I don't know what it was that was like blocking you, but I do feel Okay.
It was just really hard for me to write. It's probably the hardest thing that I do because there's so little action around writing, you know? You're expected to just sit there for hours at a time and focus, like it's just in your brain. And I am much more of an action person than I am a sit down and focus in my brain kind of person. And I never even espoused that before. Like I never even thought about that. But I think that's why it was so hard, because you have to be quiet and, you know, calm and not moving.
Yeah. So I'm looking back in my calendar because I definitely remember having writing blocks in the afternoon. And what would kill me, I'm looking right like down now, like 10 to 12. And then I have.
It cracks me up that you have this in your calendar.
Oh, that's the only way it happens.
Yeah.
I have to schedule it. But there are days where I like, if I have too much time on my calendar, I'll just piss away the day. And then it's like you, it's because that's such an ADD thing to do. You need that sense of urgency, you know, like.
Yep. Yep. And so for me, it was the end of the day. Like I knew I would feel so bad.
Yeah.
It was such a struggle. And I knew I'd feel so bad if I didn't get it done. And so then 2, 3 o'clock, I was like, crap. I just gotta do it.
That totally happened to me too. Let's be perfectly honest.
Okay. So you're not as perfect as I always think you are.
I know. Wait, that's what I said. That's why I was laughing when you said process. Like, well, you know.
Okay.
But I knew certain things had to be done. I actually made my goals. I didn't have like a daily goal for things getting done, but I had a weekly one. So I knew that like, oh my gosh, if I didn't get it done, and you can't write the book the night before, like what we did in college isn't going to work. Not that that
exactly.
ever worked.
You know? You're right. You're right. And yeah. You had a pretty quick deadline too. It wasn't like you had a year to write this book.
Yeah, they wanted the draft handed in, the manuscript handed in the end of December. But the truth is so much rewriting happened during that spring. I mean, and I ended up this past year. So we're having this just for your listeners to know, we're having this conversation at the end of 2022. I only did one live launch this whole year because I just couldn't handle it. I had so much work to do on the book and so much of my attention went there, and I couldn't launch and revise at the same time. And my revision process was almost like what some people's writing. I didn't know what I handed in was a rough draft. I thought it was like a polished manuscript. I was wrong. Yeah.
You and me both.
Yeah. There was a lot of work that happened after the developmental editor basically made the whole manuscript bleed on the floor. Like that's how much blood. If the red ink is the blood, that's what, you know, just because I have this violent image of her stabbing my manuscript with a red pen. And it's like kind of like if you can imagine like Harry Potter when he's stabbing the diary in which book was that? The second book.
No idea.
She has no idea. But the nerds listening know exactly what I'm talking about. The Potter heads, they know what I'm talking about. And the ink is coming out of the book. Okay.
Well, and the thing is that nobody really tells you how much work this is. You know, you mentioned that you could only do one launch of your program, which is, that's the business, right?
Yeah. Luckily, I did put it on Evergreen and we're looking at our numbers for the year. And now the Evergreen is so successful. I don't think I really want a live launch again. I'm like, this is great. You know, it's going to keep it on Evergreen. Just keep refining that process.
Yeah. But what we've experienced is not unique, right? I mean, my understanding is whenever you're writing a book, that's pretty much what you're focused on almost, you know, 24/7, but kind of, because when you're not writing, you're still thinking about writing.
Oh,
Yeah. And like I said, it just pulls so much energy and
emotion, right?
Yes. And
it's really hard.
It is very hard. And getting negative feedback was brutal. So I thought I was avoiding negative feedback because I was working with a book coach who was basically editing each of my chapters. And when I went through the HarperCollins process, it was very harsh. And then all the comments I got back, of course, I read in my mind, like in a mean, sarcastic voice. It's really bad. And then finally, somebody said to me, stop doing this. Read it in a neutral voice to yourself.
Or a positive voice.
Right. Like they want the people who are editing the book, they want you to succeed. They want the book to succeed.
You're absolutely right, though. That is the hardest part. I have never been in a setting where I really don't have control because ultimately the editors know what they're doing. I have never done this before, right? And so all it is, it's not true, but it seems to be just negative emotion on top of negative emotion. And I'm just like, please, I need some positive emotion. Because you've never done it before, you feel like all you're ever hearing is everything that's wrong.
So I had my mother read the book, and that's where I got the positive feedback.
Oh.
Yeah. I knew I couldn't just send her a PDF. She would never read that. So I would put the chapter in email form for her at one at a time. And when she said she read it, that's when I would send the next segment.
Okay.
And so she gave me positive feedback, and that really, really helped.
Oh, everybody I'm too needs. Mortified though, Miriam, to send it to anybody. I'm way farther behind you, but maybe
it's much better than you think. I'm sure. I'm sure it is. Yeah.
Okay. So let's get back to your book. So in sales books, you typically see talk about believing in yourself, believing in your art, but you also talk about something I've never considered, believing in your buyer. And remember, art can be so many things, right? So what does believing in your buyer mean? And where did this come from? I love this part of the book.
Thank you. I can pat myself on the back because I did make it up. Somebody was asking me, like, where is this from? So we make sure we give them credit. I was like, it's my intellectual property. So it's called the belief triad. So if you think about each thing, it's you, your product. Mm-hmm. So we define art very broadly here, your art, your services, whatever it is you're producing in the world. And then your buyer, your consumer, your reader, your collector, your listener, whoever that is. And so many times we sabotage ourselves because we don't believe in that third aspect. So the story I tell inside the book is I retell the story of Pretty... Are you going to edit that? You don't have to. So I retell the story of Pretty Woman, where Julia Roberts is going to be Richard Gere's paid companion for the week. And he gives her his gold card so she can swap her hooker clothes for something more respectable. And she goes dressed in her hooker clothes to Rodeo Drive, and the salespeople won't wait on her because they assume she doesn't have the money to pay for it. So after a more successful shopping spree, she returns to the same boutique, dressed gorgeously, loaded down with shopping bags of all the designer logos on it. And she rubs it into the salespeople. She was like, hey, you remember me? You wouldn't wait on me? Do you work on commission? Big mistake. Now, how many times, Tracy, do we sabotage ourselves when we say, oh, our customers won't pay for that, or that's too expensive for them? They don't want this. Or even just what you were saying earlier, my book isn't good. I have to say, Tracy, at the very end, when I was done, I almost handed back my advance because I wasn't believing in the buyer in that moment. It's like, oh, nobody at HarperCollins even likes the book. I should get my advance back. You know, like I had that crazy moment.
Hell no. After all that work, no way.
I know. So there's so many times when we don't believe in our buyer. So the way I see it showing up with artists is they'll say things like, oh, people don't buy art in Australia.
I was like, really? Have you been to Sydney? That's an art capital, you know, or people don't buy art in Florida.
Or during COVID.
Or during COVID. Or, you know, people aren't shopping during a recession.
Right.
So we're not believing in the buyer. And yet we're whipping out our credit cards to buy things.
Exactly. You
know, we're buying things during the recession because it makes us feel good. It feels good to buy things. So don't deny your customer. You have to believe in what you're doing so much that you feel like the world will miss out if you're not offering it. That's how much you have to believe in your art. But you also have to be willing to believe that there are people out there who will also see it. And you have to believe in them.
And so what if you don't? What if you think your art just isn't good enough? And you're completely wrong. It really is brilliant.
Yeah. Well, the not good enough thing is part of the human condition, because we as humans were designed, our purpose is always to evolve and make ourselves better. That's our purpose in life, to evolve and make ourselves better. So we're always going to have that feeling that we're not there yet, because if we were there yet, there'd be no purpose in our life. So that's something you have to recognize.
And so what do you do? I mean, for that artist who's listening and they just feel like, what if they know their art is good, but they just can't do it because it's so uncomfortable to get it out there and the criticism. And so maybe they don't know that they're good enough. Maybe that's exactly what it is. What do they do?
Yeah. So I get asked a lot, how do I know if my art is marketable? And the only way you know is by start marketing it.
Yeah.
And then you won't know how to change it to make it more marketable if you don't start marketing it. Like, who knows? Maybe they love it, but they really want it in purple. No, I'm just like throwing that in there.
Yeah.
And you don't know that until you start marketing it. And the problem with social media is you don't get a lot of feedback in that kind of way. You're either going to get, you know, you'll get a heart, or they'll scroll past it, or the algorithm doesn't show it to people. So when you get mostly silence on social media, you don't get that same kind of feedback. And that's why it's super important when you are marketing whatever it is that you're doing, is that you talk to real people in real life, however that looks like for you. Now, that could be getting on the phone, that could be getting on Zoom, that could be going in person, whatever it is that you do need to get in front of real human beings and get that real-time feedback from them.
Well, it's the whole idea of perfectionism, right? Nothing's ever perfect. And if we don't throw it out there, we can't make it more perfect anyway, because we don't really know what that ultimate buyer wants. And they're the ones that are going to help us. It's never going to be perfect, but they're going to help us get it closer to perfect by giving us their feedback.
But it's more than just perfectionism, because what I see happening, and again, not just in the art space, I see this in the entrepreneur space in general, is people have an evolving style. So that could be their art style, that could be their writing style, that could be their podcast style, that could be their messaging. And they feel they can't put it out into the world until they have that all dialed in. Well, I call that Sleeping Beauty complex. So like the Disney movie Sleeping Beauty, where they want to protect the princess. So they bring her, they take the baby and they put her into the woods, and they don't bring her out again until she's a fully grown woman. Well, you got to love your baby as it's growing up. And you got to bring your baby out into the world. Yes, when it has braces. Yes, when it has pimples. Yes, when your baby's an adolescent and you let it evolve. My podcast doesn't look the same as it did when I first started. And that's okay. And by the way, people still listen to those early episodes and they like them.
Yeah. Yeah. So ultimately, what we're doing is we're getting out of our head, where we're dreaming up all these ideas of what really is going to happen, and we're getting into action to see what actually happens, so we can correct, make it better, do it again, make it even better, you know, get feedback, make it better. It's through action instead of, you know, what we think is going to happen in our head.
100%. And bringing it back to like a baby analogy. So, and you mentioned perfectionism, which definitely is part of it. So part of the reason people don't want to bring something out into the world until in their mind it's enough and perfected and fully evolved is they don't want to fail. Now, could you imagine a baby like saying, well, I can't start walking, mom, because I don't know how to do it yet. You know, like if babies could talk. Or if a baby starts to walk and then it falls down, the mom's not going to say, well, I don't think this walking's for you. But how many times do we do that? We start something and then we fail. And they're like, maybe this isn't for me. No, that's part of the process. That's how you learn.
Yeah, it's not failing,
you have to fall
right?
down. You have to fall down. Like, and you look at the people who go to the Olympics. Sometimes they still fall down. Like nobody gets there without falling down. And those are the greatest people in the world. You have to be willing to fall down.
And it definitely gets easier and easier the more you fall.
Yes. Pima Trojan has a beautiful metaphor about failure. And the way she describes it is it's like wading out in the ocean in the waves. And in the beginning, the waves are going to, when you're in the shallow, you know how they knock you down? But then the deeper you go in the water, the waves are still coming, but they don't knock you down anymore.
Ah, that is beautiful.
Yeah, there's a really nice book she wrote called Fail Better, or it might be Fail Better. And it was a commencement speech that she gave, but you can get that in book form if you want to link that in your show notes.
Absolutely. So I don't know, as I'm sitting here thinking about all this, you know, the key really is for everything, just getting comfortable, failing, being bad at something, trying things, making them better. And if you can do that, I think you can be successful at anything that you really love and have a passion for.
And be willing to be criticized.
Isn't that about failing though?
Not necessarily. You look at the Dalai Lama, he gets criticized. Brene Brown gets criticized. Do you ever look? One of my things I like to do is go to somebody who's really, really famous, especially like either authors or podcasters, and look at how many negative reviews they have.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like nobody is above criticism. Like, and it's not necessarily that the people criticizing them are right or wrong. That's not the point. The point is that everybody is going to have lovers and haters. So like Elizabeth Gilbert, she has tons of criticism, tons and trolls and everything. And whenever you show up in the world in the bigger way, that's always going to make somebody else feel small and less than. And part of their conditioned response might be to criticize.
Yeah, I guess what I was saying is I just see criticism as like, I don't know, a rung in the whole failing thing where...
But not necessarily, because not everybody has to agree with us. So they might disagree with you, but that doesn't mean you failed.
Oh,
that's what I'm trying to say.
So
you can fit. That's why criticism is not necessarily a failure.
I totally get what you're saying now.
Okay. And when we put our stuff out in the world and we want it to be perfect and we don't want to be criticized, it's just like going back to, well, I thought that my book was going to be above criticism because I had it edited. You know, like, come on. And I was also told, you know, I didn't have to take any of the developmental edits. One of the editors who worked with me, she said to me, they had an author and I'm dying to know who it was because it's probably one of those douchey bro marketers. One of the people that they, in my HarperCollins leadership imprint that they worked with in the past year, we can guess who it is. Maybe, I don't know, declined all developmental edits. It came back and they rejected everything.
And so what did the editors do?
No. Did
they publish it that way?
Yeah.
I'm curious how the book did.
I don't know which one it was. Nobody told me. I mean, maybe I can cuddle up to that editor and say, hey, you want to tell me now? But I don't think she will. I think she has too much integrity.
Wow.
So the one thing, though, you can't reject are the copy edits, although I did reject some of those. So one of the copy editors, so in my book, the developmental editor, who is Jewish, did not like one of my subtitles said, keep it kosher.
Yeah.
She said, I don't think everyone will know what this means.
Wow.
And my response to her was like, I don't care. You know, just like, I don't care when people don't get my Harry Potter references, you know.
Yeah.
Fine. Me. I don't get your Game of Thrones references. You know, like
ew.
So okay, so with that, I kept it in. But then the copy editing came back and it was a different person who copy edited it. And she said, keep it kosher, I don't know what it means. So then I thought, do I define it or not? So in that moment, I defined it. But I have to tell you, Tracy, is that when I got my third pass back, I took out the definition. I decided that this was a reference and it was stronger to leave it in. And some people will know what it means and some people won't. And I'm totally okay with it. So when you get criticism, you have to recognize what criticism do you want to take on board and say, what can I learn from this? Is there something here I really should change? Because like earlier, I said to you, oh, I had this crazy moment when I was talking about giving back my book advance. Well, in my book, I think I also said, I used the word crazy and the editor said, don't use this word because it's offensive. And in that place, I took it out because I didn't want to alienate somebody who and have them not get my message in my book because I made a word choice that they found offensive. So there are certain times where you can, when you get criticized, is this something that you can learn from? Or is this an invitation for you to go even stronger and deeper on your own message? And one of the places that showed up, Tracy, I'm so happy that I stood my ground. That developmental editor was not happy that I didn't talk more about social media. And I took that as an invitation to go stronger and deeper in laying out my case against social media. And at the time I was making these changes, a lot of artists were moving from Instagram to Twitter. And I had this moment was like, should I put that in? And I'm so glad I didn't, because look what's happening now with Elon Musk. And yeah. I'm so glad I laid out my case, because I don't know if you heard this, but TikTok, they're trying to push bipartisan legislation to have TikTok banned in the United States.
Exactly.
And whenever you hear, by the way, bipartisan legislation, like that's as good as done. So,
yeah. So that brings me to my next question just perfectly. Great segue. So you've helped thousands of artists sell more art, and you say the key is building their email list. Why do you believe the future of marketing is email and not, as you said, social media?
All right. Well, it's getting more and more obvious by the day. So, you know, Elon Musk could possibly be blowing up Twitter. We don't know. I don't know about you, but I told my team we're not using it anymore. Yeah. I was like, I don't want to go there. I used to ask my podcast guests what their Twitter handle is. And now I told my assistant, take that off the application. Because we're not retweeting anything. TikTok, as I just mentioned, there's that. Instagram, let's talk about Instagram. So Instagram, when I started writing the book, you had a 1% chance of being seen in the newsfeed. By the time I went to do my edits, it had dropped. I went back to look at new research. It had dropped from 1% for the average Instagrammer to 0.6%. 0.6% engagement in your newsfeed. Now, what about influencers and people who are making money teaching you how to get better engagement on Instagram? You want to know what their engagement rate is? 1.18%. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's more.
So wait a minute.
Not
so
much.
If you're an influencer, you put out 100 posts and only one of those will get seen? On average?
No, that's not what it means. What it means is that if you have 100,000 followers,
okay,
only 1,000 people will be engaging with your post.
Okay, so it's engagement. They may see it, but they'll just scroll past.
Yeah, but no, but here's the difference. Here's the difference, and here's why email marketing matters. When you send an email, and you might see this with yourself, Tracy. So I have about 24,000 people on my email list and about 24,000 people following me on Instagram. Mm-hmm. So on my email list, even on a bad day, it's like maybe 25%. And let's even, you know, just let's just make the numbers easy. Let's say 20%. So what's 20% of 25,000? 5,000 people. Okay. 5,000 people will open up my email. If on Instagram, 1%, so 1% of 25,000 is 250 people. But here's the biggest difference. Here's the biggest difference. In email, a person receiving my email, they decide whether or not they're going to open the email or not.
Yeah.
So I have some control over that. I write a better subject line, maybe 50% will open it. On Instagram, I don't have control over who sees it in their feed. I have no control. The algorithm decides. And the person who may want it has no control over what they see and don't see.
Yeah.
That's the difference. The difference is email, the person receiving it decides whether they're opening it. And on Instagram, they don't decide whether they're receiving your post in their feed.
I love this because, and this is your book, right? Where you just take all the noise and you consolidate it down to a direction of, nope, this is the thing that's most important. And I remember when you were talking to me about this initially, I was told that, oh, well, you need to be on TikTok. In fact, you know, my editor brought in, or not my editor, I guess the acquiring editor was the one who said, oh, we have someone specifically who's going to work with you on TikTok. And I'm thinking, oh my God, I can't even handle Instagram. Like I just, social media is not my thing. There's too much bombarding you at all times. I can't keep on top of it. I want to respond. I don't have the time. You know, it's just too much. And I love that what you're saying is, well, just let all that go, because the most important thing is that you're communicating with your audience using email, which is what I'm already doing.
Yeah. It's the most reliable thing every single time. Every single time. When I post stuff on social media versus email, it's a huge difference how many people take action on what it is. Now, you mentioned TikTok. So one thing, you know, this is one of the things I can't remember if I put it in the book or not, but I'm pretty sure I did. So it's, I call it the death of the scroll. And when you have either a TikTok or a reel on your phone, they are encouraging you to swipe up before you even get to the end of that short form video. So what's happening is that people aren't engaging with you and your content after they see it. So I've had artists who've had reels go viral. I'm talking about 45,000 views and didn't even get more than a handful of new followers, didn't sell anything from it, didn't really have anyone take it. You know, if you look at your insights, very little action taken, because that's not what these applications are designed to do. And on TikTok, you can follow somebody on TikTok and never see their content again.
You know what? All of those. It's just not the way my brain works. And I know that there are probably, you know, women listening who that is their thing. That is their passion. They're great at it and they should do it. But I've just realized that, you know, as you say, like you've got to pick those, or you show actually in your book, you've got to pick those few things that really do work for you. And it really is about getting back down to the basics. And I agree with you. I totally think that email is one of the basics.
And I'm not the only one. Yeah. And I'm not the only one saying it. So I made sure in the book, I quoted both Marie Forleo and Ryan Dice. So basically the queen and king of marketers, you know, I got the bro one and the queen one. And I have quotes of both of them saying that the future is email. I don't know if they put it exactly in those words. That's how I'm interpreting it. But like, basically they said something to that effect.
Yeah. Yeah. You also said creativity loves constraints. And I find that I'm always more creative when I set time boundaries around my creative time. I've never heard that. So my question is, for many of us, you know, when we're making time to be in our creative, we pop into hyperfocus and we just keep going, going and going and going. So I'm just curious what that means, that creativity loves constraints. And what do we do if we pop into hyperfocus and we want to keep going? Do you think that that's bad or you found for yourself personally that it makes you less creative?
It does make me less creative. I mean, we already talked about that, where when we had more time on our calendar, we just twiddle away the day until the end of it.
But you weren't actually in your creative. You know, you were...
Yeah, that's right. We couldn't get into it because there was no constraint.
Okay.
I bet you, Tracy, that if the day that you worked on your book in the afternoon, if you had a wedding that you had to go to, I'm just making something up.
Yeah.
And you only had the 2 hours in the morning and you had to get it done before you went off to that wedding, that you would have been just as creative in the morning as you are in the afternoon. That I would argue that.
Okay. I see what you're saying. So you're talking about our ability to pop into our creativity. If we give it constraints, we can jump in much quicker.
Yeah,
but then once we're in it, when we're in our hyperfocus, go with it.
Yeah, that is one. So when you're talking about time is the constraint, yes, that is correct. But I also, when I say creativity loves constraints, I'm talking about beyond that. So, and mostly I'm talking about, there's a lot of artists who resist doing commissions. And I always find I'm the most creative when I have kind of those constraints for commissions. For mm-hmm. the book, you have a lot of constraints. I mean, it had to be a certain number of pages. It had to follow this outline. So there were a lot of constraints that we had with writing this book. You also see this type of creativity in effect when you watch Project Runway. Shows like that, the designers are always way more creative when they have more constraints put on them, when it's that, rather than it being open-ended. You'll see a lot of them flail when it's a more of an open-ended designer challenge than when they said, no, you can only make a dress out of duct tape. You know, like, then they have to get really creative.
I totally get that. So what you're talking about is popping into the creative.
Yeah, it's yes. But also when you have a constraint on you, you have to work harder to be even more creative rather than something be open-ended.
Yeah, if it's open-ended, it's just never going to happen. Even if it's something...
Not just time, though. I'm talking about like if somebody said, you have to write this chapter and all sentences must start with the letter A. I don't know. I'm coming up with like weird things.
It's true.
You know, right?
No, it's totally true. And we balk against the structure, but it truly is the structure that I believe allows us to be more creative and get the work done.
Yes. Yes. That's exactly right. That's what I'm saying. So it's more than just the time constraint. It's all the constraints help you become more creative. And I think, is that something you talk about in your community with ADD people, that it's like that is the structure helps us?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even though we think that, we want to be free. We want, you know, no constraints. We want to explore. We want to be curious. But the truth of the matter is, then there's so much of that, we can't make those connections and put them into a form that is actually going to serve us, because we're just out there, right?
And it makes it too hard to make decisions.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So ultimately, that's what it is, right?
Yes.
So why is it so hard to make decisions?
Oh my gosh, because we want to be right and we think there's a right decision.
Mm. And we don't know what the decision is that's going to be right, right? There's.
Yeah. So one thing I talk about in my book, Artpreneur, is the Choose Your Own Adventure series. Do you remember that, Tracy, back in the 80s? Did you ever read those books?
I don't. I read it in your book and I had no idea what you were talking about, but I'm sure, you know, your audience will.
No, you know, I wrote this book for 50-year-olds who have only my experience. So the Choose Your Own Adventure books, you can still find them. They're basically, it'll start off with some mystery and it's like, turn in the person reading the book, it's written in that person where they're saying, what is it? The second person where it's saying you. Okay. So you stumble upon, the cave. You can either go in the cave, or if you choose to turn right and go down the path, turn to page 15.
Oh my gosh. Can you imagine writing that book?
Yeah. So the whole book is like that. So there's all these different endings in the book. So the fun of it is to go back and find out what happened if you made a different decision. The thing is, life isn't like that. And one thing I tell my kids, which kind of annoys them, is that I tell them there are all decisions are the right decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And you're better off making a decision and making your decision the right one. And you have no way of knowing how that other thing would have turned out. There's no sense in saying, oh, I should have done this. No, you shouldn't have, because you don't know how that would have turned out. You really don't, because you didn't do it.
So when it goes back to failure, right? Where if you believe that you make the wrong decision, you fail, versus you believe that, oh no, I learned something. So now I'm going to go through this door.
That's right. And you just focus on making it the right decision. Now, they have seen that Jeopardy players who have quick buzzer skills, they actually practice hitting the buzzer faster. They are more likely to win. Now, why is that? Because they're hitting the buzzer before they know the correct answer. So that's what you need to do in life, is you have to make that decision before you're even 100% sure that something is the right thing to do. Because you will win in life when you're making quicker decisions.
Ah, so you're in action instead of in your head.
Yes, like you say.
I love it. Okay, so you have a whole chapter on pricing, which was fascinating. And I want you to talk about the placebo effect, where people value things that are more expensive than things that are cheaper. This is fascinating.
Yeah, well, they've done studies with wine where they gave people wine and they told them certain wines were more expensive. And then they ranked the wines and they found people who were told wine was more expensive rated them more highly than the wines that were cheaper. And I like that wine analogy a lot, because I know my husband, when we go to buy wine, he wants to buy wine that's around between $15 and $20. He doesn't want to look at anything cheaper than that. I know there's other people who maybe have more expensive taste than we do that only want to buy $40 wines, but he would never buy a $7 bottle of wine and say, oh, this should have been more. Now, what you're doing when you underprice your work, whether it's art or your piano lessons or your coaching services or whatever it is that you offer in the world, people are never going to say this should have been... they might say that, but that they're not going to buy it, because when they buy it, they're going to either think that it's worth this, with the number you're putting on it. And people do have a snobbery about that. So the best way you can have that perceived value is by actually raising the price. I found that in my own work, there was a class that I was offering, Watercolor Portrait Academy. And the first time I offered it for $97. And the second time I offered it for $197 without changing anything about the class. And the feedback and the testimonials I got with the $197 price tag was so much better than with the $97 price tag, because people, when they paid more, they enjoyed it more because they made sure they got to the end of it. And then when I raised the price even more to $497, that became even more true. Like, the class changed their life, you know? So it's interesting how people value something more when they pay for it more, and it also increases their enjoyment of it. So we're not only doing ourselves a disservice when we underprice our products or services, but we're also doing a disservice for the person who is buying it, because they won't value it as much as they should.
Miriam, I've had this exact experience with my program, and it's not even about charging, it's about not charging. So a couple of years ago, I started where I would offer a full scholarship to my signature program, Your ADHD Brain is A-OK. And when I went back about a year later, I discovered that not one person that I offered the scholarship program to completed it. So rather than helping them, I was actually harming them, because they were thinking, I'm sure, oh my gosh, I get something for free and I don't even do it, you know? And so what I did was I started changing it up, where I would offer them a reduced rate, but they had to pay, because exactly what you said, what we pay money for, we pay attention to. And that was the only way I discovered that I could actually change their lives. Them not doing it, it wasn't doing anything but, you know, creating more, I'm sure, you know, negative comments in their own brain about themselves and their ability. So I 100% agree with that.
Yeah.
You also said something about, which was really interesting, when people buy more than they need, it's a red flag that you're undercharging. And I, you know, thought about myself, and there are some instances where I will go somewhere and everything seems so cheap, and so I end up buying everything. And then I come home and I'm like, oh my gosh, if I had just bought one of these things and it was higher priced, I just feel like I would value it more than now I've got all this crap. Did I really need it?
Yeah, I've done that.
Which doesn't feel good, right? The whole experience is like, oh my gosh, that was so wasteful.
Yeah. I mean, I remember the one time I did it, ABC Carpet and Home. And for those who don't know, it's like a high-end boutique in New York, but they have these remnant sales, or at least they used to. And I went and I couldn't make up my mind which hallway runner I wanted for $10 each. So I bought like five of them and I ended up having to give them away because I was like, well, I'm not going to spend. But that, you know, I thought that was a good thing because I just knew I didn't want to spend time making up my mind. You know, this is a waste. I'll just bring it home with me. But anyway, yeah. But I agree with you that people just, they don't value it. And the example that Tracy's referring to in my book, Artpreneur, is when I started off doing my portraits, I didn't know what to charge. And I did what a lot of people do when they're first starting out, which is you look at what other people are charging, which means you're copying their money blocks and money and insecurities and pricing drama.
Yeah.
And so I was undercharging. And one of my clients ordered like five portraits of each child. I was like, okay, I'm clearly doing something wrong here. And then she didn't like frame them all. Who could afford to frame all those paintings, you know? Like,
yeah.
They sat around her house unframed.
You could have charged her the same price for one.
Correct.
And then she'd have one, right, that she would totally love rather
which
than
she valued and framed and hung on her wall.
Exactly. Right. So did she ultimately end up not framing any of them or was she able to choose?
Well, it was a year later I was at her house and I saw they weren't framed.
Ah.
So at that time I was putting all my watercolor portraits in mats and plastic to protect them. Thank goodness, because you can't just have a watercolor sitting around. And she hadn't bothered to get them to be take them to be framed.
Probably because she couldn't decide which one to frame.
Maybe, or you know, one frame is like $400. You know, it's like so. I mean, that's also a problem with artists. And I just spoke to an artist yesterday who did the same thing. Her first commission, she charged $200 for, and then her client spent $300 on the frame.
Oh my!
So that then you know that's a red flag too. Like your art, it should be more than what it costs to finish it.
You know, I thought your section, speaking of pricing, you have a whole section on overcoming specific objections, was brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
I don't think you missed one.
No, because we've heard them all.
Well, and I'm not an artist, like fine artist, right? But I have heard those objections for all kinds of things in life, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's totally applicable. Doesn't matter what you're doing, to be honest.
No, it doesn't. So some of the objections Tracy's referring to is like, it's too expensive. I can't afford it. I don't know if I put in there, I don't have time. I probably should have had that one in there. So I did miss one.
Are you sure you didn't have that in there?
No, I'm not sure. I wrote this a year ago. I don't know what I put in anymore. So Tracy, do you know when I used to interview people and they couldn't answer a question about their book, I assumed they had a ghostwriter. I feel so badly for making that assumption. Now that I've written a book and I understand, like, oh,
well, they just don't remember, right? Because right. I think what people don't understand is how long it takes to get a book to publication, to actually where you have it in your hands. And I don't remember what I wrote last week. I'm petrified.
Right.
And no, you did not write about the time. I'm looking at it right now. You did not write about.
I did not write about the time. Yeah. No. So, okay. I need to think about it and I want to think it over.
I'm saving up for it. I'm just shopping around.
Yeah.
This is my favorite. I have to ask, I don't know, my partner, my interior decorator, my mother. That one is just, I have to ask. That one makes me crazy. Like you cannot make your own decisions, right? So then you can hoist them on someone else. And then if it's the wrong decision, blame them. I know people like that.
Yeah. And what I want the listener to understand is the whole point of this section of the book. It's not about getting a yes at all costs and talking people into buying what it is you're selling. What's really important for you to understand is where people's objections are really coming from and understanding their psychology. Because if you're hearing it's too expensive, you may take that on and make it mean that what you're offering is priced too high when it doesn't. So that's why I put these in here. So the I have to ask my, so the rationale behind that, why people say that, is because what we said before, making decisions is very hard and your customer is afraid of making a mistake. So when you understand that the real objection is they're afraid of making a mistake, sometimes you can talk to them and find out what it is they're afraid of. And the other reason they do it is because they want to get themselves off the hook, you know. Yes. And know when you're doing this in your own life, by the way. So that's a lot of what this part of this section is about, is if you're doing a lot of this in your own life, asking people, it's because you want to be let off the hook. And I talk about this earlier in the book when I talk about why you should have a separate bank account for business and personal. You don't want to, when you're a woman in business, you don't want to have to ask your partner, your romantic partner, if you share personal finances. Your business decisions should be independent of that. And it should be based on a business decision of what is in your business bank account.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe you want their opinion, but just recognize you want their opinion because you want to let yourself off the hooks. Because if something goes wrong, you want to be able to deflect it and say, oh, you told me it was a good idea. And it's more important for you to take full accountability and full sovereignty for your own decisions. And like I said before, work on making it the right decision.
Absolutely. And I think that is where I feel so much pushback on, oh, I need to talk to my husband. Because, I mean, I get that. There are times when I do want to speak with my husband, but I don't need to speak with him for permission. Right?
Yes.
It's about that agency and being able to make decisions for myself. I'm not irresponsible, but I'm not a child either.
Right. Exactly. So that's what I talk about also. Like, check in with yourself. Do you want their permission or do you want their opinion?
Yeah, exactly. Okay, Miriam. So do you have a new ADHD workaround that you can share with us?
Yes. So whenever I find myself sitting at my desk, just staring into space, is that what you're talking about? So there's this app on my desktop called Focus at Will that plays music, no lyrics. And I do find that the music has conditioned me to get into the mode of working. I don't know if there's anything really secret or magical about the type of music they're playing, but by now my brain has kind of associated that music with, oh, now it's time to work.
That is so interesting. So automatically you play that and you're able to pop into focus.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I've spaced out for quite a long time before I remember to put it on, but yes.
And it's called Focus at Will.
Focus at Will. It also is an app on the phone, but I tend to use it on my desktop and I put my headphones on and I play the music and I set the timer. So you know how you said it with you, it's a timer. So you set the timer for like 20 minutes of that playing the music. And then a lot of times I've found by the end of the 20 minutes, I can do another 20 minutes.
Totally.
But it's really helpful to know that I only have to focus for 20 minutes and see what I can get done. And that seems to do the magic.
I love it. So Miriam, thank you so much for making my book writing process so much easier. I don't know how I'd get through this without you because you're always, you know, many steps ahead of me. You have such great advice. So thank you for that.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. You're such a good interviewer and the time really did fly by.
It does. It does. And thank you. So where can our listeners collect, own, invest, or adopt your book? And if they get the book, they'll know why I'm saying all this. I love the idea that you talk about using different words instead of buy. And I love the word adopt, especially if you're painting like pet portraits. It's so cute. And can you share the book bonuses they'll get if they pre-order?
Yes. Well, I will share that. But first, I want you to know you don't even have to buy the book. If you want to try before you buy, I'm giving away a free chapter. So if you go to shulmanart.com/believe, or better yet, DM me on Instagram. I'm at shulmanart, S-E-H-U-L-M-A-N-A-R-T. DM me the word believe, and I will send you the first chapter absolutely free. Otherwise, you want to check out those book bonuses, artpreneurbook.com. I have a 12-part video series where you can watch me in my art journal and I'll give you all kinds of behind the scenes goodies, and you're not going to want to miss that. And that's just one of the bonuses.
I love it. You know, there were so many more questions that I wanted to ask of you, but we are now past an hour. And so my thought was, you know, I guess you just got to go buy the book. It's great. I bought it. I love it. Thank you so much, Miriam.
Thanks, Tracy.
And all of this will be in our show notes. Again, Miriam, thank you for spending time with us here today. And that is all I have for you for this week. If you like this episode with Miriam, please let us know by leaving a review. Our goal is to change the conversation around ADHD, helping as many women as we possibly can learn how their ADHD brains work so that they too may discover their amazing strengths. As always, you're listening to ADHD for Smartass Women. Come join me at TracyOutsuka.com. I'll see you here next week.
You've been listening to the ADHD for Smartass Women podcast. I'm your host, Tracy Outsuka, and we're available on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Not coincidentally, ADHD for Smartass Women, it's also the name of our free Facebook group. We're a totally smartass community of successful, ambitious women who share our ADHD wins, questions, and workarounds. Join us at TracyOutsuka.com, where you can also find more information on our Your ADHD Brain is A-OK system. I spy a happier life for us, and I'll see you again next week.
Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you here next week. And don't forget to sign up for our free live virtual training, 3 days to fall in love with your ADHD brain, starting on April 15th at spyhappy.me/3days. I'm telling you, it's life-changing.